So, the subject of the talk tonight, borrowing from Rakefet titles that are a little bit more poetic, is called The Squirrel and the Blackbird. Squirrel is Snee, Snai, Squirrel and the Blackbird. But before that, I just want to relate to the fact that Tovana has never ever had a retreat with so many women that are pregnant. It almost doubles the population. We were listening to the Dharma, but doesn't take so much space. If we add the babies, it's, woo, very big course. So I do want to just say two words about breathing, meditation, and birth. We will not be talking much, at least I will not be talking in this retreat. We simply don't have time to go into all the dimensions of what meditation can do for you and what it is. There is a huge, huge teaching on the effect of meditation on health, on the body, on disease, on relaxation, etc., etc. And it's just another big subject, and it's not, there isn't time to go into it. But I do want to say that it's a wonderful preparation for the birth, because at the birth, at least in my experience from being with and you know, talking to mothers giving birth, concentration is a key. Concentration is really important. It happens by itself. The birth itself brings concentration, but there's always a need for some help. And especially if the birth is in the hospital with doctors and the fluorescent lights and disturbance and monitors and the tick, 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 and you know. So the breathing does help us to concentrate, that what we're doing here does help us to focus, to be, and to be relaxed inside the body. And to allow things to happen in the right time. A lot of the issues around allowing the rhythms of the body to happen without us disturbing them is something that we can learn by paying attention and by breathing. We kind of align ourselves, we put ourselves close to the rhythms of the body, including contractions. And apart from that, there are, if you look in the world, so much relationship between power of mind and birth. I know that I once wrote about this. For example, in India, there is a habit or a tradition that you put a flower that's closed, a certain flower that's closed, next to the mother giving birth, and the flower takes like 3 or 4 hours to open. And if the mother concentrates, deeply concentrates on the opening of the flower, it can be aligned with the opening of the cervix, the neck of the womb. So it helps the birth process to happen through concentration. My wife always had a picture in front of the, or in the front of the bed. Of it was arches in a college in Oxford, where they built in 16th century, 15th century, they built a lot of arches, actually churches in Europe. They actually, the entrances are like the birth canal, and they're consciously, if you ask, if you go back in the history of the monasteries, it has an image of the birth canal arch after arch after arch after arch. So she put one of those postcards of the entrance to a college with arches, inside arch, inside arch, inside arch, and just went inside there, focused in, and baby came out. So I think there is a connection between meditation and the birth, and it's worth exploring it. So, squirrel and blackbird. I was once in London walking about, and I went to St. James's Park. And there I saw an old man that was throwing nuts to a squirrel. And the squirrel was hopping in the grass and in the earth and taking the nuts and burying and covering and feeling good. And then would get another nut, making a hole, burying the nut, covering it, and going on to the next. And the man was feeding the nuts and the squirrel was doing this. What the squirrel didn't know is that behind it was a blackbird, that every nut that the squirrel buried, the bird opened the earth, picked the nut, and ate it. And this went on, and the squirrel burying the nut, and the bird behind digging it up and eating it. It went on. This is major, major theater. And the old man was delighted. And it does tell us that it is about our life. We tend to be busy storing things, collecting things, earning money, working like hell, getting a better life, a bigger house, a better situation, and so on. And we forget that behind us is a blackbird called time, change, sickness, whatever it is, that's taking everything to pieces again. So we keep going like this, and behind us is change, chaos, uncertainty, that's actually taking it to pieces. And in some way it defines our life. And we define our life usually by what we want, what we do, what we need, our desires, our will, what we don't want. We feel we'll be happy if we get what we want, or if we avoid what we don't want. We assume, all of us, that there is happiness. Happiness is defined by if I get what I want and I don't have what I don't want, such as disease. And that's what my life is about. And I think I'm supposing, you know, it's like a hot evening right now. There's not, the air conditioning is turned off. Supposing ice cream arrived right now into the hall, we'd feel so good. All eating ice cream. But then another ice cream would come. Well, not so. We already had one. And a third ice cream would come. And a fourth ice cream. You know, oh, we'd all be sick. The thing called being satisfied is very, very small. We're satisfied for a moment. And then the next need, the next desire. And some desires constant all our life. The desire to avoid pain and suffering. The desire to be generally happy and content. The desire for good relationships. The desire to end conflict and have no conflict and fighting and so on. We, all our life, we are busy with these things. The desire to have things and not to lose them. So, we have a concept that there is our life, and life is fine if we avoid all the problems. There's a quote from someone that said, I used to think that I what did you say? I used to think that I would find real life if except for all the obstacles and problems. And then I began to realize that the obstacles and problems were my real life. Like we see, real life will be there if I can just sort everything out so that there's no problems and obstacles and difficulties. Then I'd live, really live. If I went to India, went to this, I'd really live. But the really living is the issues, the obstacles, the what we don't get, what we do want, what we don't have. And our suffering is around that. And that's the second of the noble truths of the Buddha. And Simi talked about the first one, namely, that there is suffering in the nature of the lived experience. Not in the world. The world is just the world. There's no suffering in the world. There's no suffering in life. Life is just happening. Our relationship to the lived experience is constantly unsatisfying. And the reason is our attachment. What we want, what we don't want, that's the source of the suffering. Our addictions, our patterns, pushing, pulling, pushing, pulling. And if we think about it psychologically, all of us come to this retreat with scars, chalakot. We come with psychological scars. We come with a lot of vulnerability. We come with covers over everything that we don't want to see, we don't want to know. The hurts that we've experienced in our life, not one person can get away without hurt. Just the nature of the lived experience. We arrive in this moment, present moment, pretty like wounded soldiers. And it's not that they have the best conditions, best parents, best this, best that. It's not that. It's in the nature of the lived experience that we carry these scars with us. And mainly because we're devoting ourselves, we are conditioned to be busy with survival. That's what we're busy with. Many of us experience it in the retreat itself, the last few days especially. Things are coming up. We didn't invent them. We sit minding our own business. Completely, we're just quiet, you know. Not doing anything special. Oh, the pains come. Oh, the restlessness. Oh, the boredom. Oh, they just come. And they're really coming because of stuff that all the scars and all the wounds of battle wounds that we've had in our life before are there. And they come up when we sit still and we don't run away. And they are the issue for us. Attachment is the issue for us. And it's holding us to some extent in a prison. What is good for me? What is bad for me? I sometimes think that the image of the image we have mythologically in the Semitic mythology is of the tree, Ha'et, Tov L'ra. Actually, I think it should be Et Tov L'rali, not Tov V'ra. Because it's the wrong translation, it seems. I don't know. But what's good for me, bad for me. Good for me, bad for me. That's what threw us out of Garden of Eden. And in the center of the Garden of Gan Eden, in the center is the Tree of Life. There's no good for me, bad for me there. It's just the living, just life. Life doesn't have good, bad in it. Life is just life. And there is our freedom. In the lived experience. The good for me, bad for me is what gets us thrown out of the Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. So it's, we are sort of stuck in this framework, somewhat in a prison that all our life, and we hardly can get out of it, we are building our life based on good for me, bad for me, what I need, what I don't need, what I want, what I don't. And there's something tragic in this. It gets us, we are quite stuck. And in there is a self built from this and constructed by life from this. And it's hard to change. We can't suddenly become somebody else. I remember on one long retreat, I was in America, and I was sitting a long retreat, and one day I came to a little room that I was sleeping, and I saw there piles of papers. Now, I write a lot, and I've written a lot of books, and I'm always writing, or I used to be. And writing notes and writing papers and writing da, da, da. And I came to this retreat with a suitcase full of papers and wrote more in the retreat, never mind that, like the instructions you got, don't write. I also got the same, but I didn't pay attention. I was writing all the time. And I opened the door, and I saw this pile of papers there, and all of a sudden, I just burst into tears, cried like a baby. This is me. I'm nothing. I'm just a pile of papers. I am prisoned. This is me. I just can't go anywhere without papers, and I'm all writing everything, and I don't have any life. I'm just, this is, and if papers get lost, I'm finished. And luckily, I kind of had an understanding of how to work in the Dharma. So what I did is I stood there, I cried, I went through the pain of it, and then when I stopped crying, I went off, had a cup of tea, came back again, opened the door, started to cry again. More. And I did this a few times, and then it didn't work anymore. But we are shaped as a person by what I like, what I don't like, our patterns, our tavniyot, call them, our tfusim, our scars. And we are enclosed somewhat in this. And this is attachment. And this is why, because we're built like this, it is quite hard for us to change. And many of you have expressed it in the group. How is it that I'm doing my best? I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to do, what Rakefet says, what Simi says. I'm doing exactly, and it's still there. The pain or the boredom or the sleepiness. I did what you said. Why is it doesn't change? It's still there. In fact, even worse. We are built. It can't be changed so quickly. We are constructed by life. Sankharas means formation. In the Buddhist tradition, it's very full of an understanding of what is attachment. An attachment, hitsamdut, attachment is about being constructed by life in a way in which we have no control. In one of the ways that this is expressed in the tradition is by talking about attachment as some kind of demon, Mara. Mara is a bit like Titra Acha, the other side, the devil, if you like, but in Eastern way or Buddhist way, where the devil is really us, in us, and the elements in us that are our attachments. And they are described as Mara. And so there's four. Better now? Okay. And there's four kinds of Mara, which are to do with attachment. One is called Devaputra Mara, and it's trying to find pleasure in order to stop what is unpleasant or difficult or painful. So our constant seeking pleasure is called Devaputra Mara. Skanda Mara is the habit of constantly recreating the self just in the same pattern as before. Like we are constantly wake up in the morning the same person. And we have no control over that. With the same scars and the same difficulties, even if we don't want them, we can't help it. We wake up in the morning pretty well based on the same model as we were yesterday. Klesha Mara, it's the habit of emotionally throwing fuel on the fire. Emotionally, constantly feeding the emotions. Anger, pain, desire. We feed it. We keep going with it. We think about it. It's in the mind all the time. It goes round and round and round the mind. This kind of thing. This is another Mara. And Yama Mara, Yama is death, the habit of going to sleep. And going to sleep when things are going well for us. Dafka, when things are fine, we go to sleep. We don't need to do anything. Spiritually, that's the big problem for us. It's comfort. Spiritually, discomfort is not a problem. It's comfort that's the problem. When we feel everything is comfortable, like the castle of the Buddha, then we go to sleep. We don't need anything, no change, no problem. And spiritually, there's no motivation to look into the nature of things. So that's Yama Mara. So this is the second noble truth, attachment. And how does the Dharma help us? And now we're looking a little bit deeper into what we've been doing up to now. Because we really didn't talk about it at the beginning. We are doing this retreat in order that A, B, C, D, because it's simply just going to create more desire, more distraction. But now we've been sitting a few days together, we can a little bit see what the whole thing is about. And the first thing is that freedom for us is more important than having things comfortable, and that that's something we can only learn when we look at the truth in us. That you say freedom within the storm, not freedom from the storm by running away from the storm. What helps us and what we can work within the Dharma, and what we've been doing here in the few days, especially the last few days together, is sitting in the eye of the storm. And that creates for us a place of freedom, which is quite beyond Tovli Rali. It's actually more the tree of life than the tree of Tovli Rali. It's our ability to sit in the eye of the storm, Enasera, and be with it, and not run, and not be attached to this and that, I need this and that, and my life is like this, and I'm like that, and I have niyot, and da-da-da. It's going for freedom, rather than going for pleasant life. And so the Dharma is not about, in a way, coaching, how I can do better. Dharma doesn't say, you can be more skilled person. If you do meditation, you can get more success. I know there's American, a bit of an American Dharma that says if you meditate every morning, it'll definitely help your amount of dollars you earn. That's kind of a bit of an American version of the Dharma. And I'm quite serious. There are lamas going around teaching Dharma for wealth. But I wouldn't think that I don't think the Buddha would really be happy with that. I mean, wealth might come, it's not a problem. But it's not the seeking for wealth is the problem. It's the seeking for it is the problem. So, what we've been doing is, in a way, working with the tools, hakelim, of awareness, of ability to sit in the middle of things, ability to see ourselves, ability to look in the mirror, ability to sit steady. We can breathe and sit steady. We sit in our place. It's a power. It develops power. We develop power of trust. There's a lot of trust in this room. Right at the beginning, we talked about trust the process, trust the Dharma, trust what's going on. It'll be okay. And here it is. We're still here. I think no one left. It's amazing, trust. But it's a power. We learn trust. And if we can develop the ability to be with what is, without running away, without trying to shift it and change it, our ability to stay with what is, we're in the eye of the storm. And there is freedom. Yes, there'll be desire. There's nothing wrong with desire. Nothing wrong with ice cream. It's okay. What's wrong is the attachment to it, that your life is built around the desire. The desire doesn't stop the next and the next and the next. Desire is nature. It's okay. Let desire come and eat your ice cream. But what does it do to you the next time? And there's where the attachment comes. Or what's the thinking that goes with it? And what's the whole... So, just to be with what is a power. And we learn it here. We are not then attached to the story or the role or having to be somebody or having to be somebody better, or having to, and also the negative. Seeing things as they are is seeing the negative things in us, and seeing them as they are. There's a story that some of you know, because I keep telling it again and again, but I do like it, about a woman who dreamt she was being chased by a demon. And the demon, chasing her, and big teeth and big eyes. She was running and running across fields and trees and forests and hills and running. Eventually she came to a block, a cliff, a tuk, and she couldn't run anymore. So she turned to the demon and said, "What are you going to do to me?" And the demon came racing up, big eyes, and said to her, "I don't know. It's your dream, isn't it?" It's in our hands. They're our demons. They're no one else's. It's true that they came from life, they came from our spirit, but they're ours. We can turn towards them and look at them in the eyes, whatever they are, psychological patterns. I mean, we discussed many of them in the group. Take an example of a very common one called judgment. Bikoret. Alatsmenu or alatsvagama akherim. Judgment against ourselves, judgment against the other. Guilt, judgment, criticism. Very common. Who doesn't have it? You think, well, all our life will do it. It's just happening all the time. And people tell us, "Why are you so critical?" And you tell yourself, "I'm so critical, I'm down, I'm low." You put yourself down, we put ourselves down. And then we have to compensate and try and make ourselves big because we put ourselves down. And all that story. Instead of that, with the eye of insight, we sit quietly and we look, and there is the voice saying, "You're no good." And the voice passes by, "You're no good." But you can turn to this demon and just look it in the eyes and say, "Yeah, there's a voice that tells me I'm no good. There's a voice of criticism. Here it is. It comes and it goes. I'm ready to sit with it. Someone once told me, one of the teachers said, if you count the number of times that you have a thought of judgment against yourself, shiputiyut, machshava shiputi, when you've reached 1,000, you will never again be able to judge yourself. Just count to 1,000, and that's the end of the problem. So we look at ourselves, and we just sit with it, and that's a kind of one of the basic tools of Dharma that we learn. Ability to see things as they are, to see the demons, gova inayim, as they are, the voices in the mind, the patterns in the psychology, the subconscious things that in our subconscious mind, the tendencies and so on. And they come out here not as often as they are, but dressed up in all kinds of clothes, like pains in the body, which if we look carefully, there may be fears, there may be experiences. They're the scars, the tzalakot. Or boredom or restlessness. That's what's coming up. But they're the demons dressed up in the clothes of the demons. So partly what we're doing is looking at things as they are. And when we do that, there is a tremendous breakthrough. It may not happen all at once. It may be very slow and steady, but it really does shift things. One of my favorite films is, you may know it, is the Vipassana in Prison. And how the prisoners came out of their 10-day retreat crying, not because they became angels, but because they saw where they were at. The reality hit them, and they were able to look at themselves in the eyes and say, yes, this is my situation. And the tears came, and I'm sure those people that cried, that was the end of their life of crime. And it happens again and again. Sometimes it doesn't need Dharma, of course, to look at yourself, Bhagava Inayim, and see things deeply. Sometimes it doesn't need the Dharma. It doesn't mean that the Dharma is the only thing you have to do this, but Dharma certainly does do that job. I remember we had some retreats with cancer patients, and a disease creates so much. That's when the real difficulty arises. That's when you really can't escape anymore. There's no more comfort there. If we're still running away and trying to be comfortable and trying to sort it out and trying to stop the disease by every means, trying to kind of close the experience, we're struggling and it's so much suffering. But there were some cancer patients, or people who have cancer, that were able to look at their situation in the eyes, straight, Govainam. Yes, I have this. But there's other things too in life. My life is like this. The cancer is not the whole world. I look at it, I look at life, and I look at where I am. And for those people, the cancer became a form of liberation. It became a place of intensity in their life. So life became more on the edge. And there was a spiritual opening. And still, of course, you've got a disease, you go to the doctor. Doesn't mean to say that because you have the Dharma you shouldn't look after yourself. No question. You go and do what you need. You respect your body. You respect your life. You do what you need to do. Not in passivity. We don't need to be passive. Nothing in the Dharma says you must be passive and just accept everything and let everything give up. There's nothing about that. But looking clearly at where you're at, it's not giving up. It's actually the opposite. It's being connected to where you are. And not full of escape and full of stories and full of hiding and covering and projections into other people and all kinds of... Right where you are. Be right where you are. See where you are. Be with it as it is. And then go out and do what you need to do. and often more clear and more confident and more wise decisions in life from looking at things as they are. But there's one other aspect what happens when we look? What do we see? One thing that we see, that we know, we begin to understand that if we can look at something, then we are not that something. See what I mean? If we can see something in us, then we are not that. We are bigger than that. So say we have a psychological pattern, a tavnit, that's bothering us. If we can see it, the thoughts that come around, the pressure in the body, the pain, for example, fear. If we can see the fear, then we are not the fear. Usually, we don't see it. It needs effort, or it needs work, or it needs meditation, and we can begin to see the fear. If we see the fear, we are bigger than the fear. And the fear gets less and less and less. I'll give you an example. I used to be very, very afraid of height. And I used to get very dizzy and almost faint when I looked, you know, over the edge of a wall, and from a child. And I built my house in Clil myself. And along came the time to build the roof. And my first reaction was, oh no, I can't do this. This is not. I'll hire some people and let them do it. And then I thought, no, I will do it. And I called a friend of mine in England and said, "Would you like to come and help me build the roof? Build the roof together." And he said, "Sure." And he came, flew over from England, and the two of us started. And the first days were terrible. I went up there on the ladder. I couldn't even get up the ladder. So I get up the ladder, and I had to have 5 minutes break on the edge of the wall, top of the wall. There wasn't a roof, it was just a wall, right? So I used to sit on the edge of the wall, breathing. And I looked down, oh, again. And gradually, I started to use the tool, a hammer and wood. And if I touched the wood and touched the hammer and was really concentrated in the present, then the fear was less. So gradually, as I was up there, I used to take kind of homeopathic doses of fear. I would look over the wall, down, small, just a little look, and feel the fear, okay, and feel it. And then carry on. And then again, after 10 minutes, look again, down, and then carry on working. And if I kept doing that, gradually the fear went. I was able to reduce the fear slowly. Feeling the fear in the body, feeling the fear in the mind, seeing what it did to me, doing it or actively, and seeing clearly all the phenomena of fear in the body, especially the body. And doing it again and again. After a month of building the roof, more or less went away, the whole thing. But it's an example. So, seeing something like a fear, you are not the fear. You can gradually reduce the power of the demon over you. But there's one other thing, which is, you don't actually need to get rid of stuff. You do not actually need to actively get rid of problems, issues, or attachments. And the reason is that by their nature, they go by themselves. There is nothing stable. And this is a deep insight in the Dharma. If you look at anything, it flows and changes. We are far more dynamic than we realize. But we don't know it. Because of attachment, we think everything is fixed. We think our psychological problems are there forever, and we need 10 years in psychological treatment in order to make any change. We think we are going to be like this forever. We think all our addictions are forever. We have a model of ourselves that's pretty close, solid. But as soon as we look at the inner world, this is what we're doing. We see thoughts come and disappear. We see feelings come and go. We see body sensations come and go. Patterns come. Okay, they go. They may come back again, but they certainly go. So we begin to see the dynamic nature of our world, our inner world, that we are not so solid as we think. And this is a liberation. Take thinking. Thoughts that come and come and come and keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. What do we do with them? So we've got basically four ways to deal with them. One is to just let ourselves think them. Be in the thought. It doesn't help us. They keep going round and round and round endlessly. The other is to, by force, try and stop them. It also doesn't work very well. Because if you try and stop thinking, that just is more thinking. The third is to notice how a thought has a beginning and an end. A thought train of thinking, chain of thought. There's one that brings its brother, that brings its sister, that brings the cousin, that brings the uncle and the grandmother, the grandfather coming in a chain. But there is beginning of thought and an end of thought. They come and they go. They come, we don't know why. They turn up, but they finish. Another thing comes, and it finishes. A feeling comes, and it goes. There is a story about, a Zen story about a student that came to his teacher and said, I have a big problem with anger. How do I deal with my anger? And the teacher said, well, look, I tell you what. Bring the anger, and we'll deal with it together. So the student said, well, at this minute, actually, I don't have anger. So the teacher said, well, in that case, go to your meditation hut. Next time you have anger, bring it, and we'll deal with it. So he said, yeah, but it will take me 10 minutes to get from my hut to your place, and in that 10 minutes, the anger will probably go, and then how do we deal with it? So you see, even if you want to hold on to the anger, you can't. So you've dealt with it, because the anger goes and comes when it wants. From conditions that create anger, there is anger. When the conditions change, there is no anger. Anger comes and goes. Just look, just watch, just see the dynamic nature of our inner life. So the same with thought. Thought comes and thought goes. If we watch the process carefully, we will always see the ending of things. And when we see the ending of things, we are free. Things are not dominating our world. They come and they go, but we have to see it clearly. Anicca, change. People who have been in Goenka courses know this. Anicca, change. The changeability of our existence brings us great freedom. But one more thing on a deeper level. The fourth way to deal with thought. And this is a way of a deeper understanding. That is, if we understand deeply, really in our being, that the thought doesn't belong to us in the first place. If we understand at the deepest level that the thought doesn't belong to us in the first place. Difficult to describe it. It is about the self, as Rakefet was saying the other night. If you think about some thoughts that you've been having, do we really own them? We can't control them. The thoughts come that we don't want. How many people in the groups have been saying, I don't understand. These stupid thoughts that keep coming back and around and around and around of ridiculous, idiotic thoughts, like nursery rhymes from my childhood, songs, ridiculous, silly thoughts that just come again and again and again. But that's us. So we can't control the thoughts. We don't own them. They come because we are in relationship to the world. The world is talking through us. We are the world is us. So we're in constant relationship. All the voices we ever heard are there in us. They don't belong to us. If we understand deeply that we don't own the story of anger, it's not my anger. It's anger that comes through a set of conditions that made anger arrive. Anger is from life. Anger is nature. Anger comes when the time for anger is there, because someone did something and then you get angry. You can't, it's life. So if we have less sense that we are owning ba'alut, we understand this, less ba'alut, less ownership, less identification. It's a way, a deeper way, in which thoughts become less powerful on us, patterns become less powerful, attachments become less powerful, the demons in our life become less powerful. They're not us. We don't own them. They don't belong to us. They come from life and they go again. And we ourselves, I don't know, do we own ourselves? And ask yourself, you know, who's in charge? Who's the owner? Ask yourself. There is a little phrase from William Blake, and I must finish. There's a little phrase from William Blake that says, if we kiss the joy as it flies, we live in eternity's sunrise. Means even the joy. If we see that they don't belong to us, they see that they pass, even the joyful things, the happy things in our life, the joy and the difficulty. I've only talked about attachment to difficulty, but also the joy. We say, oh, I want to be happy, I want to be happy. I must be happy. That I want to keep. The demons I'm happy to get rid of, but the joy I want. No, also the joy. We let them go. Because there's a deeper joy, there's a deeper contentment. If we let the problems go and the joys go, because they do go, and they will go. And as in the phrase of William Blake, 17th century mystic, he says, kiss the joy as it flies. Just as it flies by, kiss the joy. Beautiful phrase. And you live in eternity. Means that something eternal needs peace behind that. If we let things go, there is something eternal, something, see, there's something spiritual which is behind that. We have to let things go, let it all fly, let it all pass by. Real happiness is not getting what you want, it's not needing to be happy. If you don't need to be happy, if you don't have to have the joy, then there's real happiness. So I'll leave you with that. And we'll take a few minutes.